You're listening to episode 12 of the Ecology Everywhere podcast. I'm your host, Arun Dainandan, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Charles Blazier and Kyle Grant. This week, we're talking about Mendel's laws and killer genes. This week, we are talking about genetic variation and Mendel's laws. Who is Mendel? Who's this Gregor Mendel character that keeps coming up in our biology textbooks? So around the same time that Charles Darwin was publishing The Origin of Species, there was an Austro-Hungarian monk and hobbyist plant breeder by the name of Gregor Mendel, who was breeding thousands upon thousands of pea plants and examining how their traits changed from generation to generation. He'd breed these purebred parent plants of different flower colors. So some of the plants were all purple with their flowers, and some of the plants, all those flowers were white. And then he'd study their offspring, which he called the F1 generation. He would then breed these F1 generation flowers, or plants rather, and study those offspring known as the F2 generation. And his findings became known as what we call today Mendel's laws. So Mendel's laws are kind of these universal and taught wide and broadly, and they're super interesting. So to get into it really quick, so Mendel's first law is the law of segregation, which states that every individual has two copies of each gene at each location on a chromosome, and that during meiosis, the genes are split between the two sex cells or gametes that are produced. In mammals, such as humans, those gametes are known as the sperm in males and the eggs in females. Mendel's second law is the law of independent assortment, and this law states that alleles which are passed down from one generation to the next are independent of all other alleles. So in other words, traits are independent of each other. Now, quick side tangent, we now know that this is not fully the case, as there are many genes, known as linked genes, which tend to be passed on together. Now, Mendel's third law is the law of dominance, and this states that organisms are able to carry genes without physically expressing them, with visible dominant genes suppressing the hidden recessive genes. Now, central to this idea is Mendel's particulate theory of inheritance, where heritable information could always be teased apart into its principal components. So when we talk about the process of natural selection, we say there is first a random generation of variation, followed by the differential replication of certain variants. In other words, changes in variation are completely random with respect to an individual's fitness. A change in one area may be beneficial in one environment, but deleterious in another. The differential replication, which occurs after this, or not replication, but rather the differential, oh no, yeah, it is, differential replication, which occurs after this random variation, is what leaves us with the traits that we see in a given population. So that kind of fits in the idea of this dominant recessive genes persisting in a population. In terms of increasing genetic variation, there's four main sources. There's recombination, which occurs when genes between parents are shuffled during the formation of the offspring through a process known as crossing over. There's mutation, or a permanent change in the DNA sequence of an individual, and there's tons of different ways that mutations can occur. I won't go into that here, but I really, really recommend you go check that out because there's a lot of really interesting stuff there. There's migration or gene flow, where genetic information is moved from one population to another through movement. And there's lateral gene transfer, where organisms pass their DNA between each other without creating new individuals. So lateral gene transfer is a major driver in how bacteria are able to gain resistance to our antibiotics so quickly. And so, without further ado, Charlie, you picked a paper this week about evil killer meiotic drivers, so I'll hand it over to you.
Perfect, thank you. So, yeah, the paper I chose this week was published in 2018 in Trends in Genetics by Maria Angelica Bravo Nunez and collaborators. And this paper is called Genetic Villains, Killer Meiotic Drivers. In the form of a review, it discusses the one exception breaking Mendel's law of segregation. So as Arun mentioned, there are many of Mendel's laws that were broken by some discoveries, but the last law that wasn't broken, which is the Mendel's law of segregation, that stipulates that diploid organisms, in each of them, each of the two alleles in the heterozygote will be transmitted equally into meiotic products. The exception to that law of segregation is called meiotic drivers, selfish loci that manage to bias the transmission of alleles in their favor and find themselves in the majority of the functional gametes produced for some of these drivers, also called cheaters, can therefore spread and even reach fixation within populations, even though they are deleterious to fitness. One of the two general classes of meiotic drivers, the other decided to focus on the killer meiotic drivers, disregarding the other class called the true meiotic drivers, known to mainly act during the meiotic chromosome division. The ultra-selfish killer meiotic drivers, as the name implies, act by sabotaging otherwise functional meiotic products that do not inherit the selfish allele. The term selfish in that sense refers to the selfish gene theory, describing the differential survival of genes constantly competing against each other, seeking to promote their propagation through time. So going back to the killer meiotic drivers, they are often seen in male meiosis, called symmetric for the reproduction or for the production of four equally viable but genetically different gametes. To visualize the situation, imagine four functional sperm cells, freshly produced in a male's testes. One of these sperm cells contains the ultra-selfish gene, and the other three contain its allele, which is not selfish at all. So the sperm cells containing the ultra-selfish gene will manage to kill the three other gametes, increasing its chances to make it to the ovum and fertilize it. So the review focused on the genes used in killer meiotic drive systems and their implications. They focus on those acting after meiotic division and using a known mode of altering transmission frequencies. These drive systems are hard to detect mainly because genetic experiments are typically done with pure breeding interfertile organisms, like Mendel's laws were made, whereas drive can only be observed in heterozygous individuals and can also cause infertility. Not to mention, drivers are constantly changing through time and can also be under the action of suppressors, which would basically make them invisible. So the first mode discussed in the review is a killer target drive system, requiring a killing agent and a target site. The target could be a protein or even a genomic locus. This system has been observed in male fruit flies, different subspecies of Asian rice, and Podospora anserina, which is a mottled filamentous ascomycete fungus. The second mode discussed in the review is a poison antidote system. As the name implies, these drivers produce a poison and an antidote. The poison in this situation kills indiscriminately, but the antidote selectively rescues the gametes inheriting the drive allele. This drive system has been observed in the house mouse, Asian rice again, and in ascomycete fungi, and fish and yeast, which the gene in question in the fish and yeast that was historically called WTF genes. So I honestly found this review super interesting, mainly because I was previously unaware that the selfish gene theory had an actual implication at such a low level. It arguably is the lowest possible level of competition we will see in this podcast. Not between species, not within species, not even between individuals of one population, but between individual alleles in one individual. And these alleles are, of course, nested within gametes and competing for the increased chances to become the chosen one who gets to develop into a larger organism. What I liked a bit less about the paper now was that they spent a little too little time going over the few discoveries that were made regarding diverse meiotic drivers. I feel like they almost forgot to explain the implications of each drive mechanism in their examples, making each discovery almost pointless besides finding out about molecular mechanisms and the genes involved. I did also enjoy the concluding remarks section because the implications were then discussed in a broader sense. They see a bright future for the next generation sequencing and the widening implementation of CRISPR technology. They even bring up the idea of using genetic villains to improve the life of humans. So as a whole, I find the whole thing very interesting. It kind of opened my eyes on lots of ideas I've been getting while reading the Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene. But I'm kind of curious to know what you guys think about that paper and that whole concept of Mendel's law being broken.
Yeah, I thought it, like you said, it's a very good example of how, you know, the gene is really the fundamental unit of selection. A lot of times when we're thinking of evolution, we're thinking of the differential reproductive success of individuals, but we tend to forget that selection is really acting at the level of the gene. So I thought that's kind of cool to see. Also, I thought it was very well written. I don't know if you guys felt the same, but it's just very a nice flow to the text and really low on the amount of jargon that they included.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the write up there, it certainly was written with a I think it just naturally fits almost like a a science communication angle here, because, I mean, even just the terminology that's used, right, killer meiotic drives, genetic villains, it was definitely written in a way that the average person, I think, could pick this up and find it interesting. I mean, there's parts, of course, when it starts to get deeper into the science that might lose a few people, but I think as a whole, it's something that can be picked up by anyone, by a scientist in any field, and understand it, and even, you know, someone who doesn't necessarily engage in science every day. In terms of, I mean, on the other hand, I think I agree with you, Charlie, that it, you know, it was kind of short. To me, it read a little bit almost like an editorial. I think they could have gone a little deeper in some sections. But certainly I think it that kind of reflects the fact that this is a very new field, relatively speaking, especially with some of these newer technologies that they mention in the conclusion, like, well, especially this, with the idea of gene editing and CRISPR, which is something I want to chat about a little later in the podcast. And I also actually just really like this idea of, like, just this division of the two drivers into these, you know, these true meiotic drivers and the killer meiotic drivers, with the true meiotic drivers essentially just looking to increase the number of copies that they're present in, which is kind of like a, you know, it's kind of maybe like annoying, like a parasite or something, but at least at the end of the day, like, all the products are still viable. The products being from meiosis, whereas these killer meiotic drivers are kind of doing the same thing, but instead of putting themselves into all these different these gametes, they're just looking, okay, well, if I'm not in it, then it's gonna die, right? So it's like there's almost this this kind of evil element, if we can personify these genes. So I thought that was really, really interesting. Just the way it was written, the language that was used, but also just the concept as a whole, I found was very, very interesting. And actually, yeah, so CRISPR. Can we talk about CRISPR really quick, or you want to get into that a little later?
I mean, you can talk about CRISPR really quickly if you want. I'll ask you my question a bit later on then.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, just the whole thing begs a question. Okay, well, this gene editing idea, you know, where they bring up in the conclusion, and I'm only bringing it now because you did mention it, Charlie. So I'm gonna jump right into it. But this idea of gene editing coming in and essentially humans playing around with all this information. I mean, what do you think is gonna happen, especially with these killer meiotic drivers? I mean, do we understand enough about it? Can we say that we can do this?
I mean, at the moment, we definitely do not understand enough about it, because we only have a few examples of this happening, and we do know why we are lacking information about this. So I think more research has to be done, and more genetic experiments with heterozygotic individuals has to be done before we even try to edit, to do some genome editing. I think CRISPR is a very, very promising technology, but at the same time, it could be very dangerous to play around with this sort of technology if we don't know what the consequences might be. You know, they talked about improving the life of humans by maybe eradicating diseases in some mosquito species, and that is a fantastic idea. Now, can we safely, or can we just, will we just cause more damage to the environment if we use that too quickly? I was going to ask, I mean, something very basic, but, like, you know, they talk about it was a good scientific communication piece in the sense that it was very accessible to the general reader before we got to the examples. Now, I wondered if you think it's useful to see genes as selfish entities that almost have a conscience and decide to propagate themselves, you know? Again, that's the selfish gene theory is a very interesting way to see selection happening on the gene themselves. But do you think it is acceptable to see genetic or genes like as a unit of selection? That's one thing. But can we see them as almost having a conscience and competing just as we see individuals competing?
I think it's definitely necessary, because this is actually, like, this is kind of the mainstream theory right now, is that, yes, it genes are the fundamental unit of selection. Now, they produce phenotypes in individuals that are actually selected for, right? But yeah, I mean, it's certainly, we have to look at it, because this is kind of, I mean, it's the most fundamental way of looking at evolution, in my opinion. There's a lot of other examples too. If we think of, let's say, like, viruses, for example, it's another good example of these sort of, you know, strings of genes or fragments of genes that have kind of broken away from other organisms and are now replicating on their own. They don't require the individual as a pathway into the next generation.
I think the idea of you know, the selfish gene, it holds ground. And like you mentioned, Kyle, it certainly is the kind of the dominant narrative that we talk about today. I think the idea behind these singular units of replication that selection acts upon is something that even predates Darwin. I mean, Darwin used the idea of the pan gene. It's actually where we get the idea of genetics and the word gene from, as these bags of I forget the exact term he used, but just these bags of this heritable information that is then passed through generations. The way he framed it was slightly different, which is why we use the modern definition of that. But I think the idea is sound. Now, whether that's the be-all, end-all, I don't know. I feel like maybe in a few decades or in 100 years or something, we might actually see that there's an even smaller unit of selection that's taking place, or that selection is acting on. I think right now the idea of the gene works perfectly, but I'm sure there's cases where this is, you know, a bit shaky, and we might find something maybe even smaller that natural selection is acting upon, potentially in viruses, like you mentioned, you know, which are essentially these bags of information that are hijacking things around them and using the mechanisms in other organisms to essentially allow themselves to replicate, which arguably makes it the most successful organism, you know, on the planet. But we don't even call it alive, right? We don't even consider viruses to be a living organism. And yet, because it doesn't contain the components to actually reproduce on its own, it needs to jump and latch onto something else in order to do so. So I think we might find something in the realm of viruses, which might kind of lead to a different unit of selection in the future. But I think for the time being, the idea of the selfish gene, the gene being the main replicator, it just makes the most sense to me.
So by that, we can almost see the gene as an individual itself, you know, and when we think about myelic killers or myelic drivers as an example, and basically the poison or the killer target or the poison antidote system, like can we see the poison and the antidote as two different individuals that are just cooperating and having an impact on some other individuals, like or on a different population?
Yeah.
You see it this way, you think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a perfect analogy. It's if one gene is dependent on another gene for a pathway into the next generation, then you could say that selection would act to favor cooperation. And in fact, that's kind of what we're looking at when we're looking at an individual. The only pathway of those genes getting into the next generation is through the individual surviving and reproducing. And so selection will favor genes that cooperate and actually move towards that kind of relationship where they're all benefiting the individual and increasing their fitness.
So when we look at these genetic villains and that bad connotation around these drivers, it is just the impact on the temporary units that is negative. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Like, yes, we might see some deleterious mutations that will cause some individuals to not survive as long or not even survive to the fetus stage. Now, do we think that the genes still did the best job they could do to perpetuate by using that myelic driver system? Or do you think it's almost like an unfit strategy to use that system if it becomes deleterious for the larger organism?
Yeah, I think it seems like to me it's not an evolutionarily stable strategy, because like you said, you're having these genes that are, you know, acting selfishly. They're replicating really quickly, but then they're actually reducing the probability of them being passed to the next generation. Of course, not all of them are deleterious. So in some cases, it is actually a very favorable strategy. But in cases where you're actually reducing the fitness of the individual, then you could expect that over time, selection would actually select against those genes. Either that or the other genes in the body, you can have this kind of, as they mentioned in the paper, evolution of genes that actually repress the activity of the deleterious part of the meiotic driver.
Right.
I like to look at this kind of like a parasite situation, right? I mean, how much these individual genes, the killer genes, are kind of in this. And if we look at these genes as individuals, and we talk about, say, a population of these, you know, killer genes, and there might be different almost species, right, to kind of bring the analogy up a level of these individual genes, and they talk about it, you know, there's many ways that they can, say, kill a cell, there's many ways that they can reproduce, you know, and they have their antidote, there's the mechanism that use the antidote, there's many other mechanisms involved. It might be kind of analogous to a parasite, where the parasite is looking to make sure that the host survives, right? I mean, ultimately, you know, if you get a worm, like a tapeworm, the tapeworm doesn't want you to die because it's still relying on you to survive, to replicate, and to eat at the very least, right? You need to eat food so that it can feed on your, you know, your nutrients. But the problem happens when you get so many tapeworms that they end up clogging the system, and then the whole thing falls apart. So it's almost like a tragedy of the common situation, right? Where one individual, you know, they all want the resource, but of course, you know, the consequence is shared amongst all of these parasites or these genes in this case. And so I think, you know, on an individual level, certainly selection is going to favor these killer genes in propagating. But I think the issue ends up becoming almost like an overpopulation issue, where we have so many of these genes present that, I mean, like you mentioned, Kyle, the organism ends up unable to reproduce, either through, say, sterility or just from the fact that it's built up so much that you know, it's no longer a viable gamete.
Yeah, it's almost like they're I think Charlie, you mentioned this a bit earlier, but it's almost like it's not something that would persist over long periods of time unless there's that kind of counteracting effect where the actual like negative impact on the individual is reduced, right? So it's almost like a byproduct of, I mean, you could look at it almost like an analogy would be like a cancer or, like you said, a parasite. It can happen because selection can favor it, but only, I mean, it seems that would only be in the short term. Over a long, long time period, it eventually ends up selecting against itself.
So there's this interesting figure one. If you look at the subtext for that figure, they talk about, and I'll just quote it really quick, it says, over time, populations evolve distinct landscapes of meiotic drivers and suppressors. And if these two populations were to merge, the phenotypes of these cryptic drivers could emerge in hybrid individuals. And in this way, meiotic drivers can contribute to hybrid infertility and speciation, which is what we're seeing. And the fact that, just the ending of that, you know, hybrid infertility. Okay, well, the hybrid is no longer able to reproduce, but that itself is a barrier, right? Which then leads this divergence of species, like we spoke about in a previous episode. But really, the idea of a landscape of drivers and suppressors. So I think, you know, I think that's where we're seeing that evolutionary stable strategies, because there's also this, you know, it's like a Red Queen hypothesis, right? Like the suppressors are trying to catch up with the drivers, and the drivers are trying to beat out the suppressors, so they keep reproducing, but then, you know, the other part is like, no, you can't, because you're going to kill me, so we're going to prevent that from happening, and there's this almost coevolution occurring, right? And that's what it's talking about, this distinct landscape. So I think that's kind of one of the ways that this persists without, you know, over the long term, completely demolishing a population or eradicating a species, right? Because as you mentioned, one could imagine that over time, similar to like our immune system, right? You know, why don't we build, if someone gets a single tapeworm, now, how come some people can survive with a tapeworm for years and years and years, whereas another person might, you know, get violently ill within, you know, a few months or something? And that's simply because our immune system is preventing, you know, let's say the reproduction of these organisms, right, in our body. We have different ways to fight these off. And so I think that there's like an interesting thing there, this idea that there's almost these, you know, if we're going to use the terminology of the paper, and these villain genes, well, there's also these hero genes, right? They're acting as suppressors and preventing the, you know, all the villains from taking over.
That's true. And that kind of brings me to my next question, you know, because you talk about speciation and infertility of hybrids. And, you know, when you have two St. Patrick populations, were unable to reproduce for a few generations. And then they come back together and these suppressors or these meiotic drivers come into play. Do you think they have an important impact on evolution and maybe the biodiversity that we see today?
Yeah, I think this is a good example of, we hear a lot about inbreeding depression, but there's also outbreeding depression that can occur, right? So it's and it's specifically because of this like incompatibility of genomes. So this is a good example, I think, of how you can get this really drastic reduction in fitness from crossing two populations that have evolutionarily diverged.
I think we might see, certainly outbreeding depression. And there's a lot of interesting implications that has, if we're looking at something like sexual selection and, is it, you don't want an individual that's too related to you, but an argument can be made that we don't want an individual that's so far away or so unrelated to you, there's almost this perfect middle ground that exists, right, when we're looking at some mm-hmm. of these selections. But just to add to that, I think another interesting idea would be looking at linked genes, right, and something I kind of mentioned in the introduction earlier, but it's some of these meiotic drivers could end up also being the the parasite becomes the host to another parasite, for lack of a better term. Another gene might link themselves to these meiotic drivers, and those can manifest themselves in other ways, right? So whether that be in a novel trait or any number of different phenotypes could emerge from some of the genes that are being carried on with some of these meiotic drivers. So maybe the meiotic driver itself might not be, let's say, an issue in a specific case, but these might actually end up being almost like the vehicle upon which other genes are transferred or rather persist and become dominant within a population, dominant in terms of its phenotype, not necessarily dominant in terms of its genotype. But that could also influence what we're seeing in terms of biodiversity and what leads to speciation, right? It could be a way that some of these mutations, these random variation that we're seeing, could actually end up dominating a population and creating this uneven distribution of those traits.
Yeah, and very rapid evolution as well.
Yeah.
So you get a much faster selection for these traits if they're linked to one of these drivers.
It's super interesting because, it's been observed mostly in sex-biased ratios, It's much easier to see when one brood is fully females or fully males for meiotic driver reasons. But now, if we will be very excited to be able to see some phenotypes or at least some physical features or morphological features in some species that were just based from these hitchhikers almost, these genes that ended up being closely linked to these meiotic drivers and ended up being dominant without being deleterious, but just made, as you said, Kyle, a faster evolution, a faster speciation. That's something that would be very interesting to find out. And that's why I think this is a very promising study or a promising field, just because with all the technology that's getting better and better every year, we'll be able to discover all these new things. And that's when it's going to come into play, and we might be able to, use CRISPR and use all this technology to better the life of humans and maybe eradicate some diseases or even, make humans fitter individuals as a whole.
So actually, you mentioned the idea. I mean, I completely forgot that was in the review, this idea that the sex ratio is changing. That's mind-blowing, right? That you can actually have, I think they looked at Drosophila, right, in this case, that you can have a complete shift simply because, these meiotic murdering genes are present in a population and shifting it. But these are also temperature determined, right? I mean, they talk about heat shock proteins in certain species causing a shift in the expression of some of these genes, which can then be these targets for these meiotic drivers, killer meiotic drivers. So perhaps, just to give an example of a species that's determined upon, environmental temperature, let's say look at turtles, right? I mean, the temperature at which the eggs incubate determines whether or not you have a male or a female turtle. And we're seeing with things like climate change that these are in fact shifting, right? As areas become warmer, we're seeing a shift in the sex ratio. But that mean, I mean, I'm not sure of the exact mechanism in turtles. Maybe it's something similar to this that's causing that. But this could have extremely, you know, far-ranging implications when it comes to conservation, because how are we going to plan for these changes? I mean, when something could seem like a perfectly healthy population, and then all of a sudden, you know, the temperature goes up by 1 degree, and we look and all our habitat models be like, yeah, you know, like, maybe there's going to be more habitat for this individual or for the species, and, you know, this is going to be a perfect population, but then all of a sudden it might just collapse, right? Because, you know, there might be this buildup of these meiotic killers, which is simply because of something like a temperature change, right? Or maybe even salinity, right? Salinity could, in the oceans, could be changing some of this, because this isn't just only on land-based organisms, right? So that's something that I think is kind of crazy to think about, that just something as small as, you know, a gene that's transferring or rather propagating more, you know, more frequently than others and also killing others could have these implications on, you know, for conservation when we're looking at something like, you know, epigenetic effects. So if these suppressors and silencers are removed because, you know, the temperature threshold has been passed.
Yeah, and it's you're kind of bringing up an idea here that it's almost as if these could be adaptive in some situations. It's like a plastic response to have these meiotic drivers in some circumstances.
So it would be interesting to see if these meiotic drivers could actually not predict the future, but almost be pre-programmed for these changes, and maybe that would favor adaptation in a favorable way, as we know about climate change and salinity of oceans, and even increased CO2 in the atmosphere and within oceans. It would be interesting to see if, in the future, our conservation worries might not be as big or even bigger, depending on how species respond to these different pressures. Genetically speaking, you know, we might, with this technology, we might be able to put our finger on some new mechanisms that are used for within cells, within gametes, just to increase the favorable phenotype. You know, it would be very interesting to see if there's something like that we could put our finger on in the next few years of study. Might not be our field, you know, it's nothing like plants or fish or kangaroos, but it would be really cool to see how this develops in the future.
But I mean, it could be, right? I mean, when we're looking at it from a population ecology perspective, I mean, we're seeing just that sex ratio change is going to have these long-term consequences. I mean, maybe the kangaroos are good at one temperature, right? We look at, okay, for example, like flying foxes in Australia, right? Every year, especially recently, we've been seeing these massive die-offs due to heat, right? They have a heat wave that goes through. And if you look at the two major species of flying fox that are, let's say, in the New South Wales region, say in Sydney, there's something like 1 or 2 degree difference, like in terms of temperature that they react to. So I forgot the exact temperatures. I think it's like 32 and 33 or 33 and 34 degrees Celsius. But essentially, if the temperature at, say, 33, all of like the population of one species, you know, it's dramatically affected, decreased. Many die, right? From they just can't essentially can't sweat, you know, they don't really sweat, they lick their hands, but they can't get, you know, the heat that's built up in their body out fast enough, but the other, you know, species is fine, but if it went up by another degree, you know, they could have this massive consequence. So I think, you know, just something like this, we don't know what's going to happen, and this could be happening, the fact that this could be happening on a genetic level, and we don't know, it's not something we can see until it might be too late, right? Until these meiotic drivers have been built up in these populations. To me, that's mind-blowing, because that means that, you know, it's almost like the whole population is just going to disappear overnight, because we, you know, we thought it was okay, we did nothing, and then, you know, bam, it's gone. Because over time, it's just been slowly, it's like a cancer, right? Just slowly been accumulating these mutations or these meiotic drivers. But I think, yeah, I think the idea and of this, you know, rapid speciation occurring because of these changes is also mind-blowing, because, you know, we don't know if maybe something like you know, the punctuated equilibrium idea from Stephen Jay Gould, you know, that could have a root in, you know, these changes. You know, we see this climatic change, you know, something changes and all of a sudden we just get, you know, all around the world these species are just you know, there's this massive adaptive radiation that takes place to fill up these new niches because, you know, of something like this. So I think that's, yeah, it's a super, super interesting thing. But they're also, just to kind of go back to the idea of applying this to our own work, I mean, this is something that happens in plants, right? It happens in bacteria. Maybe it happens in viruses at another level that we don't know. But presumably, this also has effects on behavior. So I don't know. I think it'd be kind of cool to see what effects these killer meiotic drivers have on the behavior of, say, fish or kangaroos or, you know, dare I say, plants.
Yeah, I mean, the behavioral aspect would be very interesting. I mean, we know this affects mice. It's the killer T cells or killer. Do you guys know? It's in
the haplotype.
Yeah. What is it called again?
T haplotype.
T haplotype. So it'd be interesting to see how those mice actually do they get to adulthood or do they not make it?
I have no. I wonder if they actually specified that in the small paragraph destined to the mice.
Yeah.
That was my main critique about the paper, is that they explain what is happening at the genetic level and the mechanism, but I don't understand what the implications are, like, concretely speaking, you know? It just says that some mice end up having no tail. So I guess, yeah, they make it to adulthood or, yeah, to a, like, large juvenile stage, but they don't have a tail. What they've been finding so far. And I don't know how important what the implications of not having a tail are for a big for a lab mouse, but it would be interesting to see that.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, it could also be affecting, you know, something like horns in sheep, right? I mean, it could, a tail, yeah, I don't know how much a tail really matters for some of these mice, although, you know, there could be a fitness benefit in the sense that without a tail, you know, it becomes a little bit harder for maybe predators to catch it, right? I mean, that's why some of these species, their tail just detaches, right? So it could go either way. It could also be that the predators and finding it easier to catch these guys. So hard to say, but that could be, you know, another actor for natural selection to take place. But this could also be happening on something like, you know, the horns of a bighorn sheep or you know, any other, you know, the feather color or even length, you know, of some of these birds, and it could be affecting sexual selection, you know, for in both positive but also negative ways.
Yeah, I could definitely see that happening. And to go back to the mouse example, you know, we discussed rat kings last weekend. Tailless rat could be very fit in a New York City metro, you know, so again, depends on the environment we're talking about. And yeah, I think if we'll be able to lead or to link these drivers to big, like, sexual ornaments, that would probably cause big changes in reproduction and even, like, female choice and even male combats. Like, how would male compete for females without horns, you know? Like, all the dynamics within the populations of large mammals could change because of that. That would be very cool to see.
Well, Kyle brought up this really interesting idea of these positive impacts, right? I mean, we're looking at it like a negative, like, okay, well, you know, maybe it loses a tail or maybe they lose some trait and now they can't compete anymore. But it could also go the other way, right? We might end up getting a trait which, you know, persists in the same way but ends up becoming almost beneficial. I mean, this is could be you know, seen as a way to look at, let's say, the sexy sons hypothesis. Or the good genes hypothesis, when we're looking at these different types of competition, you know, maybe there's a, you know, that this leads to the expression of or the persistence of genes that wind up making these, you know, those, like, hypermuscular animals, right? Because there's a gene that's turned off, so they just produce tons of growth hormone and wind up just massive, right? I mean, I think they have really short lifespans, but one could imagine if there's a trade-off, you know, if it happens to many of them, you know, some could survive, and next thing you know, we have these, you know, what was it, like a dog, I think, if you check it out on Google, like all these different, I think it happens in rats, it happens in, I think, chickens, happens in cows, yeah, and they're massive. So that could also be another element, you know, there could be these positive implications. And I can already imagine from a business side of things, you know, people from the gym maybe lining up, you know, if we can edit their genes and say, you know, if we just do this one change and you go sit in the sauna for like half an hour to kind of let it do its thing, you know, you'll get like a 20 pack, tomorrow, You know? So there could be, I mean, it's very obviously context dependent, but I think it's really hard to say too, right? Whether or not these changes are necessarily going to be negative.
Now, quickly to switch gears and go back to the paper, I wondered if what you thought about Mendel's laws that were slowly, you know, finding their exceptions. Do you think finding that last exception to the law of segregation makes that law any less of a law? Do you think that makes a difference if we find these exceptions to these laws?
Well, I think it makes it maybe no longer a law. I can't remember. What's the exact definition of a law? Is it, you know, we have the definition of a theory, of a, you know, a hypothesis, a theory, a law. There's all these different things. But, I mean, certainly we know that law is broken in some cases. You know, something like, you know, like gravity. You know, if we found, we do have exceptions for gravity, but does it make it any less of a valid framework? I don't think so. I think it's definitely important starting point. It's like what I was saying earlier with the concept of the selfish gene. You know, it's the best framework that we have today to look at these changes. But I don't think it's the be all end all. And I'm sure when, you know, Mendel was doing his experiments and these laws were coming about, I don't think there was a certain paradigm before that everyone took for granted, and, you know, next thing you know, they're changed. So I think they're an important framework and they'll be the foundation for what comes next, but I don't think it's the end game here.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I mean, the law, by definition, is simply an observed phenomenon, you know, so it doesn't have to be absolute, doesn't have to be the only way, like the be-all, end-all, as you said. But as long as we observe that phenomenon and we are trying to explain it, then it is a law, like the law of gravity, as you mentioned. And like, if you think about birds or airplanes, technically, they're not, like, they're defying laws of gravity. But the law of gravity is still a thing, it's still as fundamental. And for Mendel, the law of segregation is the same thing, where every allele will be segregated equally unless there's something happening that can be explained through some sort of a scientific theory or some sort of through a mechanism. So at first I did think that, oh, because we find an exception to that law, we cannot call it a law anymore, but that doesn't really have to do anything with that. You know, it's two different things to... A law and a theory are two different things, and a scientific theory actually is very different from a theory as well. Scientific theory has to be tested empirically or experimentally at least, and from that you have to be to determine what mechanism explains that phenomenon, the law. You know, like they made it, as you mentioned earlier, Arun, they have a killer target mechanism, the poison antidote mechanism. Do you think that there's more methods that these genes might be using to find their way through a higher proportion of their allele making it to the ovum, as an example? You think that's just two out of many, many other ones, or do you think these are the only two we could essentially find within the human body or within any body?
You mean the idea behind the true meiotic drivers and the killer meiotic drivers?
More like between the two, the killer myelic drivers. Like, do you think there are many other sorts of killer myelic drivers that we will discover later on, or do you think killer target or poison antidote could be the only ones that could essentially exist? You know, they could be very broad classes, and we already saw that these classes are split in several other classes. You know, depending on the examples that have been shown in the article. But do you think there's anything else, any other method? If you think about individual cooperation or interactions, do you think there's anything else that could be happening that could lead to that unbalanced proportion of gametes or of alleles within gametes?
I think it'd be interesting to look at. I mean, so the main idea is here, right, is that the killer target drive systems require that both components are on opposite, right, chromosomes or in the homologous pair, because if one kills itself, it can't. It's basically to prevent itself from self-destructing, right? Whereas the other one requires it to be on the same one because it needs the antidote and the poison to be together. Otherwise, you know, if there's some kind of switch, that's where it kills it off. And so I think that, you know, that's fundamental to, you know, the way that, that meiosis takes place, right, when you have the crossing over and this splitting amongst amongst gametes, right, and of course it's an unequal splitting. That's why, you know, Mendel's third law here is broken, or second law. But I think an interesting angle to look at, though this might be a little bit far-fetched, is whether or not we can think of you know, even outside influences. You know, can there, similar to heat, but maybe even other ways that that you know, maybe like pheromones or things like that can influence this, because we're looking at, you know, with the killer target, the idea is that they, you know, they require that it's transacting, right, on the gene. And so, or not on the gene, but on the chromosome. And so what that means is that one component has to actually modify these proteins in its immediate environment. And then those modified proteins and kind of make their way and then, you know, check, okay, is this other thing present? Yes or no. And if it's not, it's like, cool, we're going to kill you now. You know, it's like a little assassin or something. Whereas the other ones are much more immediate, which is why they have to be on the same chromosome. Because they have that, you know, they essentially have to be almost, you know, in contact with each other to be able to have that poison antidote system to take place. But maybe there's some way that different types of cells can influence each other. So not now when we're looking at the killer target cells and we're looking at this immediate environment, you know, there's still a medium that has to pass through, right? Those proteins have to go from one point to the other, right? From one locus to the other. But there's many things that can affect it from that, you know, during that process. So I think maybe an interesting angle would be to look at, well, can other cells in the body also, you know, affect this? I mean, they have the same, but maybe there's like different ways, like different expression, the differential expression of the actual individual, you know, whether that can change it, whether different individuals through, say, pheromone actions, through stress, can change the way that these drivers are taking place. I think there's a lot that can happen from point A to point B. I think that'd be an interesting thing to look at. Whether that would constitute a new type of driver, like whether it's one separate from poison antidote and killer target systems, I don't know. But I mean, with any kind of question in science, I'm always going to take the side that there's probably something out there that we haven't found yet, that we haven't looked at yet. And there's nothing really set in stone with any of this. So I think there is an opening for some difference. I don't know what it is exactly, but I think it has something to do with what's happening between these two different loci.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a cool idea, like looking at environmental or extended phenotypic effects on these meiotic drivers and kind of inducing their expression. To go back to the original question, though, I think that really this could there must be many different ways that this is occurring. It's essentially any combination of genes or these interactions that leads to a differential segregation. Like the possibilities are endless, right? It's anything that can do this. I'm sure there's tons of other examples that haven't been discovered yet. And I think, yeah, they even talk about the fact that, you know, one of the issues with these meiotic drives is that they're very hard to detect. So it's highly likely that there's many other ways of this kind of thing occurring.
And now if we think about the concept of mass extinction and how maybe most species on planet Earth might disappear at some point, you know, in a terrible scenario, then there will be more space for proliferation of smaller organisms. And I wonder if, do you think like that these mechanisms would be at the basis of evolution itself? You know, when we talk about genes that started getting together into larger entities, do you think that these drivers facilitated the process? And do you think that we could see this again in evolution if, let's say, all large animals, large species, even like talking about plankton, zooplankton, anything that like is considered microorganism, if all these things disappear from planet Earth, do you think that this process could happen again, and maybe these meiotic drivers would be the like major driving force leading to speciation or to the divergence of different ways of for gene to propagate themselves? Do you think that drivers would be one of the most important forces that we have out there?
I don't know. I want to say no, because to me it seems like this is kind of more of a rarer interaction. I mean, typically we don't think of these drivers as being the main forces of evolution, right? It's there's many, many more that are much more obvious to us, and we see them time and time again, many examples. But I mean, they certainly could be playing a role. I'm not so convinced that they're extremely important for this kind of diversification, especially when we consider that the majority of them seem to be detrimental to fitness. So, and if anything, they're actually, they may be detrimental to you in some cases. So, yeah, I don't know. I think they probably play a role, but maybe not as much as some of the other more classic things that we know about.
And one of the classic things that we do think about is, you know, the huge, like the immense age of the Earth, you know. So, you know, like most of the evolution processes that have taken place and that we know of have been happening because there's so much time and it's just sheer luck mixed with time. Am I correct?
Sheer luck?
Yeah, just luck, just like hazard.
What do you mean?
I mean, the sense that events happen, like the probability of these evolutionary events to happen, technically speaking, within our lifetime are minimal. They're just infinitesimal. They're very small. There's almost no chance that lots of these processes that we've seen happening throughout the history of the Earth happening throughout the human life. That's from Richard Dawkins, what he's been saying, you know? You know, if you take, I don't know, billions of years or several hundred million years, this is what allows all these events to happen within our knowledge, is that these things won't happen in a human lifetime, but they might happen if we give them enough time to happen through luck.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would think that, yeah, if we're looking at evolution, I mean, it's evolution is across generations, right? So in a human's life, I mean, that's 100 years. How many generations are you getting in whatever population you're looking at? It's a lot harder to see evolution than if we're looking at, say, 10,000 years. So I agree, we're looking at kind of a snapshot in time. So it may be kind of hard to actually observe this happening. Although there are examples, too. Like, we do know that evolution can occur quite rapidly in some cases by these chance events or stochastic events, right, that lead to speciation or just freeing up of resources that allows for that speciation to occur. So, I think it's just a matter of, like you said, looking at the time scale that we're kind of observing evolution is going to make a big difference on what we can actually see.
I think definitely looking at the you know, that time scale is a very important component for this, because it's easy for us to look backward and say, well, this is why this came about, this is why this came about. But looking forward, I think the predictive ability is very, very difficult. I mean, we can try to make models to see where we're gonna, you know, where a population is gonna go, where we're gonna see speciation, but I think it's ultimately, I mean, it's near impossible, because we're trying to incorporate every climatic variable, you know, every internal environment, every individual effect of every gene, and you know, the interaction between those genes. I mean, yeah, statistically speaking, it's essentially impossible to predict where these things will go. And I know Kyle and I, we spoke about this, I think a couple weeks ago, this idea of, you know, if you were to roll the dice, will they always land the same position? Yeah, in theory, if we have the perfect model. But I think the idea of having this perfect model to be able to do that is essentially, you know, it's zero, right? You know, so when it comes to actually looking at this random, so if we try to say take a specific change, right, in evolutionary time and say, well, this is going to happen, I think that's going to be impossible. But maybe we can predict certain trends, you know, on a shorter time scale, whether it's within our lifetime. I don't know. Yeah, maybe in some cases. In other cases where, you know, let's say reproduction rates are just much, much longer, you know, very slow reproduction. Maybe not. So I think it's very, very species dependent. It's very maybe even environmentally ecosystem dependent, the rate of change within individuals. But whether I think this is a major driver, I think it's like an iceberg. I think we can only really observe what's above the water, but I think there's so much more below it that, you know, much of it could be neutral. You know, these neutral mutations, neutral changes that essentially they're just there, but they don't really change the fitness of the individual. Some proportion of it is going to be deleterious, whether it's small or big, it's hard to say. I'm sure there's certainly a bias towards these, you know, studying these negative deleterious genes simply because that's what we're looking for. That's where we're worried. And then above the water, there's going to be, you know, some other, you know, or within that rather below water air, there's going to be some positive changes too. But right now we're only looking at a tiny, tiny, tiny tip of it. And we're like the Titanic about to float on by.
I do think that we really don't know anything. We're very naive to that field. We're in 2018, or we were in 2019, but that paper was published in 2018. And they seem to have just recently discovered all these myelic drivers. And I think there's much more that has to be discovered to understand really the implications of this. And maybe in 5 to 10 years, we'll be able to say with confidence that, you know what, I think these drivers had a huge impact on evolution back, you know, a few thousand years ago, a few million years ago. But at the moment, it's kind of hard to say because we have just so little examples covering myelic drivers. And as you mentioned, the predictive ability is really limited to our models and to proxies that reflect just barely what we can observe, you know, with our human senses. And there's always so much happening below the water. And yeah, that's pretty much, you know, there's still a lot to study about this topic, and that's why I found it extremely interesting to look at it now. And probably we'll have to follow how it develops in the next few years, but I'm sure like 50 or 100 years from now, we'll know even more about this technology and these drivers, and maybe they will become just integral part of the next Dawkins edition of the Selfish Gene Book. That's something I'll be really interested to see, you know. So on this note, do we have anything else to add regarding the paper or regarding our discussion on that selfish gene theory?
There's a pretty cool section from actually like the book, The Selfish Gene, where he actually talks about these kind of bottlenecking effects of genes and how cooperation of genes can be favored in certain situations. But in other situations, genes won't cooperate or actually will replicate on their own. And so he uses this kind of colony forming algae. And this algae can actually like replicate by breaking off, but when you just break off a chunk and it regrows. Do you guys know? There's a name.
It's not budding, is it?
Yeah, just budding. I think it's budding, yeah. Anyway, so like in these situations with these organisms that can bud, you actually get a high degree of like incompatible genes in these two groups that are actually, they're one individual, but they're like replicating on their own and they're doing very different things because the pathway into the next generation is not shared by the whole organism. It can actually, the genes can go into the next generation in a number of different ways. And then viruses are another good example.